Malcolm Honlein with us. Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. We call this the weekly update here on a Friday morning at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
It's a good to see you back on terra firma. And awake at the after your all-night trip.
I appreciate that. This is always the best when we're able to do this live, and I thank you for all your cooperation. In no specific order, because we have so much to cover from the last 2-3 weeks, but some of the things that are immediate that I think people just need to know about, there's been a major social media explosion with the news of, at least from my vantage point, with the news that now Palestine is a full member of the United Nations General Assembly. Malcolm, am I right that there are still some restrictions and that no one can really regard them as a full member at this point?
Yes, absolutely. And until the Security Council hasn't approved it, although this week they were given a seat at the table, which is offensive enough, but you are correct, there are limitations, but it's a propaganda war. And, you know, this is a victory for them at least, but in the hostile atmosphere of the UN, everything is expected.
And speaking of the UN, it was with tremendous, I don't want to say enthusiasm, but certainly with great speed that the United Nations, the leader of the United Nations made sure to condemn what was a very, you know, unfortunate episode, of course, a raid that took the life of some UNRWA workers. But I say it like that in terms of the speed to get out there, because we have so many times emphasized how UNRWA workers are part of the, you know, part and parcel with the efforts against Israel. And I know it's terrible when people lose their lives, but it also has to be put into perspective that they are undertaking activities that are unbefitting a true UN representative.
Of course, the UNRWA people were involved, many of them, in the attack on October 7th. That's been clearly documented. UNRWA itself has no reason to being there. They had 30,000 employees, many of whom are engaged with the Hamas and with the PIDG and with other groups in Gaza. It's an anachronism that shouldn't, just enriching a lot of people with money and aid that comes in that hardly benefits the people. And the quickness with which Guterres, the Secretary General, in this instance and since this war began and even before, he has gotten caught in the clutches of the hostile anti-Semitic, anti-Israel structure of the United Nations. And while he started off like his predecessors, usually being fair and more balanced, we see quickly how it changes, and it has in his instance as well. So the whole UN structure is geared to be anti-Israel, and that means its agencies, and we have to credit the United States and stands against it. And a few of the European countries every once in a while, along with the Marshall Islands and Palau, you know, the great powers that stand up with Israel each time in the UN.
For those who don't like traffic on First and Second Avenues in New York City, is this next week that it starts, the UN session, the week after? What's the schedule?
Well, theoretically, it really starts but the big week is the week after, when the heads of state come. And Netanyahu will be coming. I think he's arriving on the 24th, but he's not speaking until the 27th. So he'll be here over Shabbat. Usually it lightens after the president of the United States leaves, which is after the first day, I think. And he has a reception, I think, on the Tuesday night. And yes, that's the hell week in New York. So those who can avoid coming into the city should do so.
All right. Since you mentioned the Prime Minister of Israel, I said to the listeners a couple of times this week and earlier this morning during the show, for me, this is a little bit of a different trip to Israel, because often I'm in one area or two. And in this case, because of the project we're working on, I was really everywhere. I went north to south, east to west. And, you know, Malcolm, you pick up a sense, and maybe you would tell me that it's silly to gauge things this way, but I must have seen, I don't know, 80 to 90 overpasses while traveling throughout Israel over the last few days. And every overpass is giving you some type of indication of what people want or don't want. And I'm talking about hostage deals and their opinions about the Philadelphia route and what they think of Bibi and what they think of Bibi staying in power. And there's some, you know, of those overpasses with, you know, balloons and biyachad ninatzeach, we will win this together, et cetera, et cetera. Every political point of view and every passionate slogan is up there at some point. And I think we sometimes, thousands of miles away, lose perspective on what's happening in Israel. How they're not, I don't want to say divided, but there's so many points of view coming from so many angles. People are, you know, in some cases feel like they have no direction. And all of this comes together in one small little nation. And I just wanted your opinion on that. You know, we talked about with Rai Fass earlier in the week, how there's still a sadness and trepidation in the country. But I think when you see all these points of view being tossed around in the streets of Israel, it only makes for, you know, a much more difficult period of time for our brothers and sisters there.
Yes, and it is exactly the situation that confronts. Look, the divisions were there before. It's a political, there's a lot of political exploitation. There's a lot of very sincere frustration. And after almost a year, one can understand it. The 100,000 people about displaced from homes in the north and the south, the not seeing an end yet to the war, and let alone the heavy toll that has been taken, and the loss of life. And every couple of days, unfortunately, we read of another Israeli hero falling in the conflict. These frustrations are natural. The economic implications are very severe. We don't feel it every day, but those who visit, and you go down and you see people whose businesses have been closed, 40,000 small businesses closed last year in Israel. And the, you know, so all of these strains and stresses, let alone all of those who have political agendas aside from it. But remember that even if 500,000 people go to the streets, that's 5% of Israel's population, that people put up signs for and against what's going on. But the majority of people still support Israel pursuing and getting rid of Hamas and the infrastructure of Hamas. And they've had, you know, significant victories. Of course, when there's an incident, then it gets the international press and it gets all of the attention. Yet the remarkable event that took place in Syria, which I hope we'll get to, does not get that kind of coverage. So we have to remember, you know, Israelis are involved. They always were much more politically committed. Look at the turnout at elections, et cetera. There is a frustration of both pro and con of Bibi, and very personalized with him, and the media there focuses on him. The circumstances all lead to it. But remember, the people are marching with Israeli flags. They're not burning Israeli flags. It's not like here. It is a feeling of commitment to the state. And I think, you know, it's true. The strains and stresses take a toll on people. Go outside, then want to take a break. But I think ultimately they will all come back, and Israel will come back together once this is over.
And being politically involved, as you said, one of the most interesting things to me, I mentioned this to the listeners a couple of times, one of the most interesting things was everyone I spoke to, who I didn't really know, it could be a cab driver, staff at the hotel, everyone who knew I was from New York or from the United States said to me, who won? Who won? And at first, I didn't know what they were talking about. And then it became obvious they were talking about Trump-Harris debate. They're right. Curious to know who won the debate. And not even what did they have to say about Israel, or what did they say about the, you know, the future of a one-state or a two-state solution. Who won, they needed to know, because they have a tremendous interest, it seems, into who the president of the United States will be. Now, this to me, is, and I know you might argue that I'm making too much of a difference between this era and others, but this to me seems very different than other times, because I think the Israelis, for such a long period of their history, paid no mind, quote unquote, I know some, but generally speaking, to who the president of the United States would be. And now it seems like their future, they feel, hinges on who's going to be sitting in the White House.
That is probably true, but I would say that I always found it remarkable the degree to which Israelis knew more about American politics than most American Jews that I encounter, and would ask me more specific questions about it. And this goes back many years. It is because of the importance of the relationship and the media attention that the Israeli press gives to American elections, and the feeling of commitment to the significance for Israel. It is important who rules in America, who you know, which direction the policy will go. And this is something that Israelis wrestle with to a great degree because so much rests on it. I think this time it's been hyped even more. And there are a lot of things they don't understand, just like Americans don't understand a lot of the dynamic of what's going on. And, you know, I think the debate maybe only confused it more. So and when you're in such a tight race, you know, where it's not obvious who the winner will be. It heightens the tension even more and the interest in it. But despite the fact that they are overwhelmingly focused on their domestic situation and the regional situation, what's happening in the election is very important to Israelis.
Oh, no question about it. I think they follow it even more desperately than they used to. And as you said, they've always been involved. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored digital radio. Around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com and the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course, the beloved NSN app. By the way, in a debate that didn't have much policy in it, and I would guess that you and other pundits have said that, right? There wasn't much policy discussion outside of a couple of areas. There wasn't that much policy discussion. What did you think of the comments regarding Israel?
They were very brief. We didn't see significant policy discussion, not on that and not on other critical issues. I think, you know, we've seen the reaction that people pick up aspects of each of the candidates' discussions. The President Trump's comment about Israel in 2 years won't exist, which a lot of people took umbrage at. Although he was trying to show that the weakness of the policies that would be adopted by the new government, but he didn't make any point about the Abraham Accords and the difference that he made, that made in the region, and could have been, I think, had many more vulnerabilities he could have exploited. And she as well did not really focus on it, but people look even for the emphasis of her words about, you know, to stop it now and et cetera, but she said that wouldn't hold up arms. But the fact is that the administration did hold up arms for a while, and while continuing supplies are going on, there are a lot of vulnerable points that could have been raised, and we never got into that discussion. But it's not just on this, on Iran, on other things. It was very superficial, I think, in terms of not drilling down. And you had an hour and a half to do it, to get into to real nitty gritty on the issues.
Yeah, and we got to get to Syria and one other major issue, I know. But I just, because you mentioned this in terms of the foreign policy issues, when a report comes out that the United States, through its president, is now going to approve the use of Ukrainians or the Ukrainian use of long range Western missiles, do you think that has an effect on the foreign policy in general, and that, you know, if they go ahead and make that move or agree to it, that could help Israel in terms of their usage of weapons in the long run, or it's completely unrelated?
It's unrelated, I think, in terms of the relationship comes to the fundamentals about how Americans feel about engagement abroad and the degree to which they want to see the weapons. And we have a big deployment, even though we're taking one of the aircraft carriers back, I think for routine maintenance, but it leaves only one aircraft carrier. And I think their presence there really was significant. And we have to acknowledge the cooperation with CENTCOM and Israel's participation there, and the head of CENTCOM regularly visiting Israel like every other week. And the deployment was a deterrent to any adventurous attacks that might have been on Iran's agenda, though I'm not so sure that they really wanted to engage because they knew the price that it would pay, they would pay for it. The relationship is that, does America become more isolationist? Does America is America seen as a reliable ally? And I heard an interesting speech by somebody talking from Taiwan perspective, an expert on the China and related issues, and he said the degree to which what happens with Israel impacts in Taiwan because they see whether America is a reliable ally. And right, we know that's certainly true in the Arab world, that they look at how we live up to our commitment to Israel and the special relationship that exists and has existed for many years. That it's an indicator, it's a barometer to them about America's willingness to stand up. So yes, to that degree, everything is it has an impact on people's perspectives and perceptions.
Right, but when it comes to reliability vis-a-vis Israel, as you said, it probably is unrelated. But I do get that in terms of a general picture of how the United States treats its allies around the world. All right, before we get to one of the most sensitive topics of the last 2 weeks, so let's do the raid in Syria, the weapon site, secret weapon site in Syria. Now, you say it didn't get the attention it deserves, so tell us, give it some attention and tell us what went on and how significant this was on Israel's part.
Well, it didn't get the attention because obviously Israel didn't comment on it. And only today, I think we saw some leakage on it. But Israel raided in a mountainous region in Syria, this research center, which in the media made it sound like it was an academic institution. This is an Iranian front built deep underground. Deep underground when they thought it wouldn't be vulnerable because it was within this mountain range. And Israeli helicopters brought an elite unit, the most elite units there, and they rappelled down, took the region by surprise. They killed the guards and were able to completely destroy this manufacturing place where they were assembling rockets with high precision guidance systems that were, it's close enough to the border with Lebanon that they could smuggle it to Hezbollah. Because, as you know, whenever they try the cross-country shipments, Israel tends to eliminate and make sure that the delivery doesn't take place.
They intercept.
And that's true by various means. Of course, some do get through, and we see the tremendous collection of rockets that are in Hezbollah's hands, and they fired again 100 yesterday, and every day they seem to have the capacity to keep firing, even as Israel takes out the launchers. But here, what's significant about this place is that it was a huge Iranian investment. It was there were no Iranian troops there, as far as we know now, or has been revealed. But it was it's a major blow to their efforts. And of course, that this would also be able to supply the Iranian militias that are in Syria. And we've talked about them many times. There are also reports that Israel kidnapped Iranian officials. That does not seem to be borne out. But it was a remarkable thing where the soldiers then were able to go back to the helicopters. The aircraft kept any support coming close to the site until the execution of the plan to blow it up. And then they were able to leave without any casualties. It was amazing.
It's unbelievable, and one can only guess the type of preparation needed to do this. It is, and in terms of the materials they brought back, I mean, we're talking about very significant, what would be regarded as classified, or we don't know what's in whatever they returned from there.
Right, that's why it's classified.
I'm wondering if there's anything, because remember with the whole Iranian operation that time, there was some type of feeling in advance that what they got was really important. But I guess because of the location where they got it from, this has got to be important as well. I mean, how could it not, right?
First of all, it was important in the raid where they took out, you know, all the documents which prove what was going on in their nuclear program and shared them with the United States and others.
Right.
It was proof. It was irrefutable because it was their documents. It wasn't Israel's. And that raid was amazing. And they're still going through the tens and tens and tens of thousands of pages of information that they secured there. Here, it wasn't so much to get the information as it was to eliminate this manufacturing site. And it is completely destroyed. But yes, in the course of it, they always recover computers, other information that is of great value.
Over the last couple of days, there's some indication that Sinwar's demands have been decreased, or on certain things he's ready to make a concession. The upshot is any closer to a deal today, possibly, than a week or two ago.
They are masters of manipulation. They know how to play all of the parties like a fiddle. They have made their demands mainstream by virtue of just sticking to it and sticking to an agenda. Sinwar has one agenda, and that's Sinwar, and that is to survive this. He surrounds himself with hostages still, and the negotiations are not moving rapidly in any direction. I've spoken to people who are involved. There is increased pressure, but this all could have been resolved very easily, either with Sinwar's elimination. And if Israel hadn't taken a very careful approach to this, and again, there's another report by perhaps the highest ranking European military official yet, all of whom sustain that Israel is conducting the most careful, the most limited operation with taking into account the lives of the civilians. This is at least a fourth, fifth, sixth report by officials from Europe and the United States, Spence from West Point, who said that this is the most humane war ever fought, urban warfare. And these things don't make headlines, but one after another. And you remember all the warnings. The administration told them not to go into Rafah. It'll be a massacre and a massacre. What happened? What happened with the attack in Lebanon? You don't hear any talk of civilian casualties because there weren't. And Israel is trying. And when they hit an UNRWA facility where terrorists, it's the terrorists. It's the fact that they exploit them as a front to protect them. And that if Israel has to hit it to get key operatives, and some there is, you know, collateral damage, that's inevitable. But the responsibility is that it's a violation of UNRWA and of international law to put people in mosques and in schools and in these facilities to protect them. And they use them then as the civilians as human shields. That's the violation.
And not to indicate that Israel may not keep its word, but if they would make a deal, which this was the thing I saw most recently, that Sinwar, you know, again, wants safe passage and his own safety, and, you know, before anything else, obviously. I can't imagine he'd be dumb enough to think that if he was given safe passage, that he still wouldn't have a target on his head, no matter where he went. Again, not to condemn the Israelis. I'm sure they are men of their words and women of their words, but you know what I'm saying? I mean, even if they went ahead and made an agreement like that, he still would have to run around the world thinking there's a price on his head.
Well, Israel generally keeps its agreements, but as the people carried out the Munich attacks and many others, they know, and as many in Lebanon have found out, that Israel has tremendous capacities. And obviously, Sinwar is a war criminal, and he can't be forgiven for what he's done. But right now, making a deal, you know, he will then have to live the rest of his life in a rat hole, which is where he belongs. But look at the guys, Haniyeh and all the others who are all war criminals, who traveled the world, and at the appropriate time, somehow, you know, they met their fate.
Justice was served. All right, Malcolm, now an opportunity for you to talk about the resilience of the Jewish people. And I'm referring, of course, to the families and specifically the parents of some of these hostages, and to discuss the brutality and the terror and the inhumane conditions. And obviously now, after all this information and videos come out, that the hostages are being kept in. And remember, everybody, we're still at day number 343 for the significant number of our brothers and sisters. The saddest thing of the last couple of weeks since we've spoken is obviously the murder of the six hostages and the aftermath, seeing Israel thrown into this terrible, terrible state of mourning. And then, of course, the final piece to this, I don't know if it was justified or not. I don't know if you think it was appropriate or not, but watching Bibi sit there being the target of a very frustrated, understandably so, parent of a hostage. Give us, in what was the worst thing to happen over the last couple of weeks, give us your perspective on this terrible six hostage episode.
None of us have words for it, and none of us can put ourselves in the position. Many of us who have worked throughout all of this past year and have met with the families regularly and talked to them regularly and engage in every kind of outreach possible on their behalf, it's a devastating blow to see these young people, and then to see the conditions in which they were held, and hear reports of from others who got out, of people being held in cages for long periods of time, and the fact that there was blood and other things on the floor, the inhumane suffering that they have endured, living underground for months and months, not seeing light, obviously having no contact with family. It depicts the nature of the enemy that Israel faces, And it's a moral dilemma about how do you set the priorities? Do you not go after and end the war because you want to protect the hostages, which is the route Israel has taken, is to try to be surgical in those areas, and to use intelligence and everything to get the hostages out. But the magnitude of this of suffering that is imposed on the people of Israel, with all of the other damage and everything, every family takes this personally. And of course, those who are loved ones take it even more so. And you think about the suffering of those who are still there. So I hope everybody remembers them, the tefillot and the prayers, and we continue to advocate and not let the streets be left to the hostile groups that mock the hostages and Israel's and Israel Bichlal in this. We have to remember we're starting a new campus season full blast ahead. And as you will see from information we'll discuss in the coming weeks, that this is not limited to our campuses. It's in our K-12 across the country. Thousands of Jewish parents are taking their kids out of public schools, and Jewish teachers are leaving. And I'm telling you that the Qatari money that we've seen on, and others, the Chinese money on the campuses, is in the public school systems across America as well. We've seen the poisoning of the American population, and it will take many years till you root it out, because by the time this generation, this current group of people who have been now indoctrinated 5, 6, 7 years, things that we're just finding out, you know, then they come to campus and, of course, are primed for the hostile attitudes, and the resurgent anti-Semitism continues. And while law enforcement and others, and we have legislative agendas which are not being passed by the Senate, but some on local levels and other levels, there's just so much. We could spend many hours on this. But the nature of the threat, which, as you know, I've discussed on this show for 10 years, 12 years, we saw the nascent elements of this, but nobody could have predicted that it would emerge as it has, with people being paid, with large amounts of money being funneled, both from foreign sources and domestic, that this infrastructure of terrorist supporting groups in America, this is a violation of law, we believe, and you will see lawsuits being filed as they are, not only against universities and for their violation of the rights of Jewish students, but also for these groups being complicit, because advocating and a terrorist organization, a designated terrorist organization, is a violation of American law. There's a lot that has to be done. We have to take this on as our war on this front. It is very serious and will only continue to expand. And we've only had a week of the universities being back. And despite the fact that many introduced new measures, we are seeing the virulence has not diminished at all.
So death to America chants and burning the American flag are simply within the rights because of freedom of speech and expression.
Well, there's some places where it isn't. You've seen the enactment of the anti-masking law. We should credit Nassau County for doing it. But also in Florida and other places, we see some universities where they are taking more stringent action not to allow buildings to be overtaken. And yet in other places, they're still doing it. And there has to be a consistency to this. The resignation of university presidents, many over the last year, hopefully will send a message, but it's not enough of a deterrent. The fact that funds have been cut off is a very important step. We need more. We have lawsuits, perhaps 20 to 30 now pending against universities and students, and we have to back the students completely and be there for them on campus, off campus. And one of the ideas that was brought to me, and I think is a really good one, that we have a solid type operation that people in communities and on campus know when there's a demonstration or when events are taking place, where they need support from the community, that they can put out the word and people will come and be there with them and then with the community.
Beat them at their own game, because they use social media and WhatsApp to gather people within minutes for their side.
Exactly. So we can have, I think, a rapid mobilization system where if there is a community, especially we have an isolated campus, that 20 people coming from the community can make a big difference. You saw that there were four guys marching down campus in and people were yelling that they're vigilantes and whatever. But the fact is they got out of their way and they had an impact. And we have to begin to be more I would say adversarial and greater advocacy, both verbal, but also in the physical presence that we stand by our students on campus and everywhere.
Malcolm, I thank you. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak, please God, next week.
Shabbos be well.
Malcolm Honlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations, weekly update with us on a Friday morning, Erev Shabbos, right here at JM in the AM.